Senator Braun on COVID-19 vaccine mandates. The state is holding a lot of local income tax in reserve, plus federal school funding transparency and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending December 10th, 2021.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller, a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com.
This week, Indiana U.S. Senator Mike Braun says he doesn't support government mandates around the COVID-19 vaccine, including efforts to stop companies from requiring it. Braun is currently leading a bipartisan fight in Congress to halt President Biden's rule that would force companies with at least 100 employees to either get the workers vaccinated or undergo weekly COVID testing. Senator says he thinks the cost of losing employees outweighs the benefits of getting more people vaccinated against a virus that's still killing about 24 Hoosiers a day.
Because we've been spending trillions of dollars to get businesses to keep their employees through this whole venture.
But Braun also isn't backing measures that would prevent companies from requiring the vaccine on their own. Indiana State House Republicans are currently pushing a bill that would effectively do just that.
I'm a little apprehensive on that happening simply because of what it might mean to where you try to impact businesses in their own decisions on other issues down the road, the precedent it might set.
Braun encourages people to get the vaccine, calling it a miracle. Is this a risky position for Braun politically? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat, Ann Delaney. Republican, Mike O'Brien. John Schwannis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, Statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting Statehouse reporter Brandon Smith. Ann Delaney, Braun seems to be in roughly the same place on this as Governor Eric Holcomb. Is that a risky one for them in the GOP?
I think it may be, actually, because, he wants to show that he's not a complete crazy anti-vaxxer. So he wants to show that there's some rational basis for his position. And that's all it is. I mean, his whole gimmick with this supposed bipartisan effort to stop mandating vaccines, just so we could stop having 24 Hoosiers die a day. It's obviously fruitless, because even if they manage to pass it, it's going to be vetoed by the president, so it's not going to go anywhere. So all he's doing is trying to wave one flag to the one piece of red meat to his base, and another piece of red meat to the employers who want to protect their employees and want to keep. You know, it's one thing to say we've paid them and we've kept them employed. Well, they're not going to be employed if they don't live through this. And, I think his position is really not very well thought out. But having said that, I do think it's somewhat risky for him and for Governor Holcomb, because the crazies in their party, the anti-vaxxers, are controlling the primaries in their party. And both of them want to run for other office and will face opposition from people like Todd Rokita, who are not going to split hairs on vaccines. They're going to be completely anti-vaccine.
Mike O'Brien, are Mike Braun and Eric Holcomb risking losing or at least upsetting a core constituency for Republicans by saying businesses should be able to choose whether or not to mandate these vaccines?
Well, it's interesting that position's viewed as moderate, if not left-leaning. But it's actually the most ideologically conservative one. It's the one that says, let's allow businesses and their unique circumstances to determine whether or not and weigh the variables of a vaccine mandate that may alienate workforce, a vaccine mandate that may protect their customers, lack of a vaccine mandate that may reflect the type of business they have. They have 1,000 employees, but they're all sitting at home by themselves. So I think his position, and then pair that with, like the governor has, an encouragement for folks to get vaccinated and try to build public trust in that among people, especially in the Republican Party base, who are distrustful of that. So it's a position, I think, from the governor and, in my opinion, from Mike Braun, it's one of leadership and rationality and conservative, applying conservative principles that keeps the government out of these private businesses and let them make their own decision.
If it's conservative, you should let every individual make their own decision. That's what the Republicans stand for.
Well,
those individuals can also decide whether or not they want to work there. It's a pretty robust job market. If you can go down the street and work for somebody else that says,
absolutely,
hey, come here,
let them go.
We're not going to make you get vaccinated, and that's the market at work.
That's exactly what I wanted to ask you about, John Schwanes. So Mike Braun, when speaking to reporters this week, said, you know, he's apprehensive, as we heard in the piece, that he's apprehensive about telling businesses they can't mandate the vaccine. But at the same time, he also says every business and every individual should be able to decide for themselves whether or not to get vaccinated. Are those mutually exclusive?
That seems a bit difficult, trying to parse that particular position on any number of fronts, not only related specifically to vaccinations amid a pandemic, but other types of medical questions, reproductive rights questions with women. You know, we could really devote a show to sort of reading the fine points or the tea leaves about what his statement was on that. But there is some, I think, some inherent inconsistency here. But I think I think Mike's assessment is right about this. This is basically not a sort of a rash position he's taken. It essentially is defending the status quo. And by that, I mean, we currently have in Indiana, for instance, it's an at-will state. Employers can fire you if they don't like the way you part your hair or blow your nose. They don't need a reason as significant as a refusal to get a vaccination. So, and we've traditionally given employers a lot of latitude in how they manage their workforces. So essentially, this is an endorsement of that position, which is a status quo. And as far as alienating a portion of the party, yes, there are some people who might see this as treasonous on the part of Mike Braun. Ideologically, you look at another faction of the Republican Party, which perhaps is the better, the more willing to finance campaigns, the business community, manufacturers, large employers, the chamber types, if you will, who do not want to see mandates, handcuffs put on employers about what they can and can't do.
And that's exactly the fight that's playing out at the State House here in Indiana.
These are better heeled. You may have more zealous and more vocal people on one side of the party, but if you look at, and we know politics, money's important. If you look at where the money is, it's with the, should we say, the chamber, the business wing of the party. And that would be very supportive, I think, of Braun's position.
Nikki, we've been talking about this from a very political standpoint, but Mike Braun is a business owner, too. Should we assume that that's also maybe factoring into his decision here?
Well, absolutely, I would think it's factoring in. You know, he doesn't want to be told by government to do something, and he doesn't want to be told by government he can't do something. I think that's where a lot of the businesses are coming in. This whole fight sort of reminds me of this business rights versus individual rights of a couple years ago, what we called the Bring Your Gun to Work bill. And it was where businesses would say that people could not have guns in their vehicles, in their parking lots while they came to work. And legislators passed a bill against a lot of business opposition that said, yes, you can. You can bring your gun because to and from you might need to defend yourself. And there were some limits on it has to be kind of locked away and hidden and that kind of thing. But I'm very much seeing a lot of similarities in those two cases.
I hadn't thought of that, but that's a great point. The state is holding roughly $750 million in local income tax reserves, according to a report from the Indiana Fiscal Policy Institute. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Samantha Horton reports, the study suggests a reduction of the surplus could lead to millions of dollars distributed to local communities.
Current state law requires a buffer of at least 15% in the local income tax reserve, state accounts that hold and distribute local income tax funds. The law was passed in 2016 as a way to protect from future recessions. Author of the study, Larry DuBoer, says even under extreme recession scenarios, only a small number of counties would run out of funds in their accounts.
Essentially, the system that we designed to prevent negative balances is working too well. And we're preventing negative balances, or we would prevent negative balances in recessions bordering on Great Depression scales.
DeBoer says relaxing the balance requirement could free up more than $200 million.
Mike O'Brien, is this reserve level for locals a little too cautious?
I think the rate at which, and this money is accumulated because of the increase in tax revenue kind of system-wide, has drawn new attention to it. It's been a complaint for several years now of local government that the state holds this money or collects it all and delays dispersing it. So this friction between the locals and the state isn't new. What is new, and this is playing itself out in several different ways, is this record level of revenue that we're experiencing. We saw it last session when, you know, at about the same time the federal government was shoveling several billion dollars into the state realized another $2 billion in estimated tax revenue. That's led House Republicans to call for a reduction in the business personal property tax and maybe the personal income tax. It's led Senate Republicans to say, hold on a second, let's see what's real and what's not. There's a lot of dials you can turn here that are being proposed to be turned, whether it's the reserve requirement here or tax rates, you know, at the statewide level, at the state or local level. It's the right conversation to have, frankly. I mean, how you disperse this excess revenue, maybe wait a second and see. Prudence may be the right answer here, and see what's real and what's not. Can we realistically rely on a record increase in tax revenue, which the corollary of which we're already seeing, which is a record increase in spending? And we saw a lot of money go out the door in the last couple of weeks of the session as the state tried to spend down that excess surplus. It's a bigger conversation than just, you know, is this 15% in local reserves or 12%? It's system-wide right now.
And, Delaney, to that point, is this the same, you know, is this sort of following the same conversation as whether or not to cut taxes at the state level? Should it just maybe wait a little longer to see how things settle out?
I don't think so. I mean, this problem of the state operating as basically as a bank and insuring against things that have not occurred, you know, and holding money that's desperately needed at the local level has got to be adjusted. I mean, what amazes me about the Republican Party is that they're all a bunch of Johnny One Notes. Okay, we have record increases in income at the state and the local level. And so the first response is don't invest in the future. Don't invest in infrastructure. Don't invest in children. Don't invest in getting good qualified teachers. It's cutting taxes, okay? We've cut taxes here. And that was supposed to, you know, was supposed to bring all kinds of new high-paying jobs to the state. We haven't seen very much of that. We have income coming in here, largely because the federal government has put a lot in. But now is the time, it seems to me, to catch kids up in school for the education they missed during COVID, to put preschool into place across the board, to fund our universities, to pay our teachers. And their first response is never to invest in the future. It's always to cut taxes, usually for people or industries that don't need it.
Well, I think a lot of those investments were just made in this last state budget when we had all that influx of money. Nikki Kelly, this 15% level, lawmakers have been talking for a decade that I've been here about how we want that prudent budget reserve levels are 11, 12, maybe 13%, but usually around 11 or 12. Well, that $200 million that would be freed up, as we heard in the piece from Samantha Horton, that would be by reducing it from 15% reserves down to about 11 or 12%. Can lawmakers tell locals with a straight face, well, we only need 12%, you need 15%?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I mean, over the years, over multiple Republican governors, it's been in the 12, 13% range. So why suddenly, you know, they're you know, having such a larger reserve for locals? I'd like to hear the explanation for that. And obviously this $200 million, I'd be curious from Mike, he said that this has happened. I'd be curious how much of that $200 million has come in the last year versus built up over time. And also, you know, I mean, it would be a one-time hit, but it also would be a slight, you know, ongoing amount of revenue every year for locals as well. So it's, you know, certainly a worthy discussion to have.
All right. Well, time now for viewer feedback. Each week, we post an unscientific online poll question in conjunction with our Ice Miller email and text alerts. This week's question, should the state reduce the amount of local income tax revenue it keeps in reserve in case of economic downturns? A, yes, or B, no. Last week, we asked you whether Indiana lawmakers should effectively ban private companies from enforcing COVID-19 vaccine mandates, as House Republicans are pushing. Just 10% of you say yes, 90% say that's the wrong move. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, Indiana schools got an unprecedented amount of money from federal COVID relief, but it's often hard for parents and community members to see how their local districts intend to use the money. The aid has already paid for districts to spend in ways they couldn't afford before. They've expanded summer school, given stipends to staff, and bought technology. The plans that school systems post online, however, are not consistent. South Bend Schools has a detailed dashboard on its website with spending aims details. Karima Fowler is the CFO of South Bend Schools.
There's a lot to be done, but we really do have an opportunity right now with these funds. I think every district does have an opportunity to not only fill the gap, the learning loss gap, but how do we reimagine education for our students in Indiana?
Fowler says even if people don't use the tools, the information online helps the district build trust. You can read the full story from WFYI's education team at WFYI.org, and I'd encourage you to do that. But Nikki Kelly, are there serious transparency questions to be asked regarding all this federal money?
I mean, I suppose you could make the same argument for every dollar they spend, whether it's state or federal money. You know, it's not the easiest thing to track, and you have to be familiar with, you know, the systems that are out there in order to look at spending and look at plans. You know, some sort of basic, you know, similar format report would be nice. That South Bend site is awesome. I went on it today. It's amazing. But, you know, there are districts who might not have the personnel to be doing that or the expertise. I mean, we hear a lot of, they get kind of yelled at a lot for spending on administration. You know, who do you think that would count towards? You know, it would spend on the administration. Someone in that superintendent's office is going to have to update that thing, you know, all the time.
John Schwanis, to that very point, Nikki brings up, there are practical concerns about the level, perhaps, of transparency, constant transparency you could do in a school district. Should Hoosiers be cognizant of those when asking, hey, how are you spending all this money?
Sure. I mean, ideally, Hoosier voters and taxpayers would care about how the dollars are spent. And ideally, the people who spend those dollars, the school districts, would be very transparent about what they're doing and the decisions they're making. I think I agree. South Bend is an exemplar here in terms of what it is doing. It really sets the bar high. Now, maybe there are some practical reasons why some of the smaller districts can't match that kind of level of sophistication with its display in real time of how dollars are allocated. But it certainly is a goal, should be a goal, it seems to me. And if you just say, oh, it's too tough, we can't do it, that's sort of not a very sound argument. I mean, managing anything is tough. And if part of it is making sure your stakeholders know what you're doing, that needs to be incorporated into the workflow. Because the benefit, it seems to me, in the end is if you have that kind of relationship that certainly South Bend is trying to nurture and build and maintain with its core constituency, in its taxpayer base, if and when that school district or others need to, as they often do, go to voters and say, we need additional money for this, we need additional money for that, and it will be a question on the ballot next time you go to the polls, who do you think is going to fare better? The district that has been very upfront and very forthcoming and been a partner essentially in how dollars, public dollars are spent, or something, a district where it's all sort of happening off the radar? I would guess that the public would be more amenable to the former, not the latter.
Yeah, Mike O'Brien, John just brought up exactly what I wanted to ask you about. There's been so much conversation the last year or two at the state level from the federal dollars about how much money schools are getting in funding. And particularly when it comes to the transparency of these federal dollars, how important is that going to be over the next few years as schools inevitably have to go to the voters and say, hey, we're going to need a little bit of money from you?
Well, we'll certainly play into the referendum, potential referendum in those districts. I'm all for more transparency on federal dollars. You're kind of setting up a cliff of intellectual honesty here, though, as we kind of go from spending to transparency on curriculum and whether or not we start posting that on the website and all these same school districts who are for transparency on federal spending are also going to be for transparency on curriculum. It'll be interesting how this transparency conversation plays out in education.
And Delaney, actually, Mike said exactly what I wanted to talk to you about, which is there's been a lot of, I mean, we've seen across the country and here in Indiana, there's been a lot of focus and attention and, quite frankly, anger being directed at school boards right now for reasons mostly having to do with curriculum issues, as Mike just pointed out. But is some of it going to end up being this too, where it's, hey, you were supposed to get a lot of money. How are you spending that money? Is that anger going to end up in that direction too?
There's a lot of anger out there. There's no question about it. And a lot of it's based on misinformation. It seems to me school districts in particular could follow South Bend's example and tell them how the money's being spent. You know, the state, I know it's a lot to ask, but could provide some guidance both on suggested ways that money should be spent and maybe helping them to develop formats for larger and smaller school districts that can get the information out there that people and reporters have a right to look at to see how the money's being spent. The anger on curriculum has largely been stoked by the Republicans for wearing masks or vaccine mandates or testing or this nonsense about the kind of curriculum that isn't even being taught in K-12. So, you know, if the curriculum were out there, I don't know what people would say. We had slavery in this country, okay? We have racism in this country, and to pretend it doesn't exist is it's not truthful. So where does that, you know, critical race theory doesn't come into this at all. But if you're going to be teaching about the history of this country, you have to teach about the fact that we had slaves and the fact that we discriminated against African-Americans and immigrants and women in our past history. I mean, that's part of who we are. And, you know, I don't think there's any harm in letting parents get that information easily through the internet, if that's what the school district would want. And I should think that the state and anybody else who complains about administrative expenses, you could point to that and say, what we're trying to do is inform the residents and the voters in this community of how we're spending the money and what we're teaching. And if anybody can fault that, good luck.
Yeah, I think we're not the last time we're going to talk about that curriculum issue. But for now, thousands of Indiana National Guard members are unvaccinated for COVID-19, despite a recent federal deadline to do so, according to a report this week from, hey, Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. There are 11,500 members in the Indiana Army National Guard, which faced a December 2nd deadline to get vaccinated against the virus. And Kelly writes that just 63% are vaccinated. The Military Times reports unvaccinated guardsmen won't be eligible for federal training or pay, which includes monthly drill weekends. Some Republican governors have pushed back against the mandate, with Oklahoma's Kevin Stitt seeking to ignore it completely. But Governor Eric Holcomb says he's leaving the decision to Indiana Adjutant General Dale Lyles. And a statement from the Guard in Kelly's story says, ultimately, this is a matter of readiness, and the best way to help maintain the Indiana National Guard's readiness is for our troops to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Nikki, amid the current COVID surge, the Guard is being deployed in Indiana hospitals. Should patients be concerned about unvaccinated guardsmen helping treat them?
I mean, I guess that's a fair question, although you could say the same thing about, we know that there are medical professionals who aren't being vaccinated as well. And in fact, IU Health this week, you know, requested the National Guard come in, and they were one group who even before the Biden vaccine mandate, put a vaccine mandate in, and several, I don't want to say a number because it's not accurate, they did fire several employees. So you could, you know, find that kind of interesting. The part of that that I was a little surprised by is that Governor Holcomb, who has been against mandates pretty strongly, about as strongly as he's been in favor of people getting the vaccine, you know, just kind of standing pat and not pushing back on it. But then again, he is a military man, and he's probably taken a number of those vaccines, like the anthrax vaccine and every other one that they've had to do. And so I think that's where he came at it from.
All right. Well, that is, unfortunately, Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Stay safe, stay healthy, please get vaccinated if you can, and join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations and by Ice Miller. Ice Miller is a full-service law firm committed to helping clients build, grow, and protect their interests. More at icemiller.com. The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.